All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you very much. Please be seated. Morning.
Morning.
We welcome you to the Idaho Supreme Court hearing cases in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho today, September 18, 2025. On behalf of the entire court, I want to say how pleased we are to have students here from the Coeur d'Alene Charter Academy. We know you've been studying government in the classroom, and this is an opportunity to see one branch of government in action. So thank you for taking the time to be here with us, and we hope today gives you a better understanding of the rule of law and an appreciation for how the courts fit into the broader framework of government. With that, the case that you're about to hear is entitled Beardsley versus Ratliff Family, LLC, number one, case number 51543. The Ratliff Family, LLC, number one, H. Lorraine Ratliff, James Ratliff, Jr., Larry and Sherry Munt are the appellants. They are represented by Tyler J. Anderson. The respondents and cross-appellants are, or is one party, Anne Marie Beardsley, represented by John F. Magnuson. Counsel, do either of you have any preliminary issues to take up with the court prior to your argument?
Not for our part, Your Honor. Thank you. No, Your Honor.
Very well. Mr. Anderson, it looks as though you've reserved 20 minutes. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. Chief Justice Devin, Justices, and Counsel, may it please the Court. As the Court introduced, my name is Tyler Anderson. I represent the appellants. And I'm going to start with the relief that I'm here to ask the Court for today. It's two prongs. The first is for this court to reverse the district court's order dissolving the Ratliff Family LLC number one on grounds of illegality under Idaho's adoption of the Uniform Limited Liability Company Act. And the second is to affirm the district court's conclusion that Ms. Beardsley failed to meet her burden of proof or persuasion as to a finding of oppressive conduct sufficient to warrant dissolution under Idaho's adoption of the Uniform Limited Liability Company. And today I'll be talking about specifically 30-25-701 and the subsections under it. To frame the issues for the court, at first blush, it might appear that this is a run-of-the-mill dispute about how family LLC ought to be run, or in this instance, resolved. But I believe the heart of this appeal, and what I hope to focus most of my time on today, is the question I believe the court is called upon to answer is the meaning of the term illegal. And under Idaho's adoption of the Uniform Act, which of course was part of the Uniform Law Commission, goes by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, but the case presents far-reaching issues that I believe could pose an existential threat to all LLCs in the state of Idaho. And although the issue framed is fairly simple to state, it has some dimension to it, which is what type of illegality counts and is sufficient to support the dissolution of an Idaho LLC. And we've obviously spent a lot of time. This case was filed in October of 2020, and the history predates the filing. But we've spent a lot of time looking at, since it's a Uniform Act, whether other courts have interpreted this provision. And I'm here to suggest to the court that this is not only an issue of first impression in Idaho, it appears to be, at least in the LLC context, the issue of an issue of first impression for any appellate court in the United States. And this appeal, of course, arises from the district court's judgment and order of judicial dissolution. And I read the court's summary, and I believe that the summary is accurately stated, so I don't want to spend too much time into the facts. Eventually, there was a falling out that led to Ms. Beardsley filing a lawsuit to dissolve the LLC that was filed in October of 2020. The named defendants in the case were the remaining members of the LLC. That was her mother, her sister Sherry Munt, her brother-in-law Larry Munt, and her brother James Ratliff Jr. And before trial, the defense invoked a provision of the operating agreement. They call it the company agreement, but it's an operating agreement that where Marcus Beardsley waived in 1997 the ability to seek judicial dissolution. The district court rejected that argument, and the defense offered an argument that Ms. Beardsley failed to adequately plead illegality based upon the Kootenai County building and zoning ordinance violations. 3-day bench trial ultimately was taken, and the district court found, out of all the theories presented, that the Kootenai County building code violation and the zoning ordinance violation going back to 2013 was sufficiently illegal to dissolve the LLC. And just to make a finer point, the building code violation was constructing a cabin, a structure without a building permit, and the zoning violation going back to 2013 was having a second structure on the same parcel.
And Mr. Tyler, you mentioned the violations going back to 2013, but correct me if I'm wrong, the cabin was actually built earlier in the 2000s, around 2002?
That's correct, Justice Meyer. Absolutely. It was built in 2002. So the notices of violation came up in 2013. They were issued in September of 2013. They were recorded October 21st of 2015. And on that point, going back to 2002, it came out at trial that Ms. Beardsley was well aware of the cabin and actually helped construct part of it. And then the cabin issue and zoning issue, building code violations were raised in the litigation, and the district court concluded that warranted dissolution. And the district court took the testimony of David Callahan, who was the Kootenai County building director of the building department. And his testimony is these types of violations are commonplace. That's in the transcript of page 97. And he also acknowledged that the particular violations in this case did not pose an imminent threat to safety. That's page 99 of the transcripts. He testified that it was not uncommon for the county to simply record the notices of violation and then just wait until they arise and pop up as an issue.
Just so we're clear, when you say record the notices, what do you mean by that? Maybe our students understand. Is that going down to the county recorder and making them part of the record on this parcel of property?
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what it means. And it gets a stamp just like we would see for any recorded instrument, and it becomes part of the title.
Potentially, might call a cloud on the title?
That's a fair way to put it. It needs to be removed, ultimately. And I'll get to it was in circumstances regarding that removal. But Director Callahan offered some interesting testimony that his staff doesn't have intimate knowledge of all of the violations that are recorded in Kootenai County. And to his word was, there are hundreds of violations that are languishing in the county. So at the time of trial, the county didn't take any action on the notices. They were never pursued criminally. And going back to 2013, to put a finer point on Justice Meyer's question, Ms. Beardsley became aware about the notices of violation. She went to her parents, who were the managers at the time, and was led to believe that the violations had been handled, is the term that she used in her testimony, and that's at pages 663 and 664 of the transcript.
And the parents being the former managers of the LLC.
Yes, they were. They were the managers from 1997 to 2018. And so there was no evidence that came in at trial that Ms. Beardsley tried to get a building permit and was denied. She tried to get a site disturbance permit to move the road around her house and was denied, or tried to take any other action that the county said, you cannot do those things because of the existence of these notices of violation. And now, as we know at this point, those violations won't come up because they've been cured. And it's in the record at pages 1241 and 1243. That's the releases of the building and zoning violations. So getting to the relief stop on the question of illegality, there's really three questions that underlie that analysis, but I want to focus primarily today on one of those. But those questions are whether Ms. Beardsley waived the right to seek judicial dissolution in 1997 when she signed the company agreement. The second question is whether underlying that issue is whether Spiersley failed to adequately plead illegality as a basis for dissolution. The one that I want to spend the most time on is whether the district court erred in concluding that the building and zoning violations were sufficiently illegal to warrant dissolution. So I'm going to rest primarily on the briefing as it relates to the retroactivity issue, but I would like to say while I have the opportunity that the waiver was completed in 1997. And at the time, the law in place, and that's it, Section 53-668 of the Idaho Code, allowed those types of provisions to be enforced. And the statute expressed the legislative intent to, quote, give maximum effect to the principle of freedom of contract and the enforceability of operating agreements. And paragraph 4 of that same section, 668, stated the legislature's intention that future amendments to the Act shall be construed so as to, shall not be construed to as impair the obligations of any contract that has existed.
And so,
go ahead.
I was going to say, so when the Act says it's not going to impair any contractual obligations that exist, and when the contract that everybody signed, or the LLC agreement that everybody signed, is, okay, we're agreeing to create an LLC under the LLC Act, including any future amendments to the Act. And when the Act is later amended, why doesn't that amendment control when the parties agreed in the agreement any future amendments will control?
Well, and that was part of the district court's analysis. And my best answer to that question is the amendments that came in the future weren't expressly declared to be retroactive. And so you kind of have this dichotomy of at the time in 1997, the idea from the family's perspective is that there will be no judicial dissolution sought. And the law changed, and obviously the lead-in language to the company agreement says exactly what you're suggesting, and that was the district court's analysis. But I think we also have to look at whether it was expressly declared to be retroactive.
Right, because my point is the agreement, even in 1997, said we're going to prescribe these provisions and then we're going to apply the agreement.
Right.
And when the agreement says, hey, we agree to any future amendments, why does it matter whether the amendments themselves say they're retroactive? Because when they sign this agreement, they all agree we're going to be bound by any future amendments.
And that's the issue, Your Honor. It's they did essentially, I'll use just kind of my own words, to agree to roll the punches as it relates to future amendments. And that language is in there. But at the same time, the legislature in 2015, when it adopted the Act, didn't make the prohibition against seeking judicial dissolution to be retroactive and then make it clear that the 1997 waiver, which was effective, somehow is mitigated, destroyed, however you want to look at it.
Let me ask you, Justice Ahn anticipated my question, but let me ask you two things. One, will you please keep your voice up so everyone
sure.
can hear? But the second is there anything in the operating agreement that would override or be interpreted in a different way to, well, I'm going to stick with the term override, the provision that the family agreed to that they would roll with the punches, to use your term, with respect to amendments of the LLC code?
The only thing I can point the court to is Section 6.1 itself, which is the provision that says we will not seek judicial dissolution and we will not file a partition action. The intent was clear that this property stay together as a family for the benefit of the family. That's the intention of the claim. Ms. Beardsley, and again, I'll rely on the briefing in terms of she didn't plead illegality on the basis of the zoning and building code violations. The complaint does not have any reference whatsoever as it relates to those issues. But really what I want to talk about for the best time that I deserve is whether the regulatory violations here are sufficiently illegal. And this issue, I think, has some dimension to it because not only when it comes to this case, but staking out the legal precedent for the future as it relates to LLCs in the state of Idaho and the potential unintended consequences that might exist as a result of affirming the district court's ruling. Because if the answer is yes, that any type of violation, whether it's a regulatory violation, fraction, scheme, ticket, whatever it is, that fits the definition of illegal, then you could have a manager driving a company-owned vehicle with a speeding ticket or a parking fine, and that could open the door to illegality sufficient for a member to seek dissolution. And I think the unintended consequences that could potentially result is it's as easy to dissolve an LLC for that reason. I think we may have a problem with business entities forming LLCs in Idaho. I think we need some certainty as it relates and confidence as it relates to not being subject to dissolution. So,
counsel, just so I understand that you're arguing that we should read the term illegal as set forth in the relevant code provision in a way that avoids an absurd result. I'm just wondering, again, under Verska and some of our other case law that discusses statutory interpretation, do we have the ability to read the word illegal so that it only applies to what we would say in law school, malum per se type crimes? Those are crimes that are illegal because they're bad, like murder or rape or burglary, and say that it doesn't apply to cases that are malum prohibitum, regulatory offenses like parking violations and speed limit violations.
Justice Mueller, I believe you do have that authority, and I think the grounding for that authority also applies in another section of the LLC dissolution in 4A, which talks about unlawful conduct. And so, of course, when the court has to construe and the statutory construction to give meaning to the statute as a whole, the dichotomy between unlawful and illegal conduct is suggests that the court could be...
Could you explain, to follow your premise, what is the difference between illegal and unlawful? Why are those not synonymous?
It's undefined, but the way that the code talks about it is if a party can prove, a member can prove, that the conduct of all or substantially all of the company's activities and affairs is unlawful, that's one avenue to dissolution.
So, again, why is that different than illegal?
Well, and that's part of the task, I believe, in terms of the legislative intent. The legislature certainly could have used unlawful in both sections, illegal in both sections, but it chose to.
I haven't done so, but I suspect if I went to a thesaurus and I looked up illegal, unlawful would be one of the words listed as a synonym.
And that's fair, but I'm just doing strictly from trying to assist the court in terms of the statutory construction. But I do, to answer your question, Justice Mueller, I do believe that this court has the authority to determine that illegal means criminal. And on that point, so let's talk about the criminality of the notices of violation.
And I'm sorry, I want to delve, because we're jumping past legislative intent really, really quickly, and I'm struggling with the argument that we should interpret those words, unlawful and illegal, differently. Okay, and I understand that ordinarily we say we're going to, if you use different words in a statute, we're going to give each meaning. But there's a qualifier in those statements of law, which is when possible, I believe. And so the only evidence I've seen you put forward for, the legislative intent was that these should be interpreted differently, is that they used a different word and then a dictionary. And I'm not sure that either one of those establishes a legislative intent, particularly where this act is modeled on a uniform state law, that those two different words are used there. That commission creates comments that explain why they're suggesting these laws. And you look at the comments, and there's no explanation that unlawful and illegal are supposed to mean anything different.
And Justice Sotomayor, you take my point in terms of where I was going to go with it, is that the commentary doesn't talk about illegality, it doesn't talk about unlawful, so we're kind of left with it. It does talk about oppression. But So we're kind of left with whatever the National Commission or state laws gave us. But I'm not here to argue that unlawful and illegal couldn't be construed to be synonymous.
Then let's address the statement you made right before that then, where you said that illegal clearly means criminal. Aren't there some regulatory violations that are bad enough, although they may not result in criminal violations, they're the type of things that we would take very seriously? For example, sewage laws, putting a septic tank in a way that might poison a community's water system. There's violations like that that may not count as criminal law, but I think most people would think they're serious enough that they're very unlawful.
I don't disagree with that either. I guess where I was going, and maybe I misspoke, is that one way to view it would be that illegal could mean criminal. But, and I want to kind of put this into a matter of routine. So when you look at the offenses in this case, the notices of violation, they were not treated as criminal. And there was no crime prosecuted, although it could have been, because Coupe County Code ties back to the Idaho Code that gives the county the authority to treat those offenses as a misdemeanor. But it didn't. And one of the things that struck me is it's an Exhibit P in the Exhibit Record of 93 and 94, and Exhibit Q in the Exhibit Record of 95 and 96. The notice is a violation when you look at the case number. It's a CB case number.
It's a what?
CB, but as compared to CR. So the regulating authority identified the notice is a violation as a civil case.
I guess I'm concerned, though, about this argument now that we judge whether something is criminal by whether or not the governing entity chooses to enforce it or not. I mean, taken to its logical extreme, if we have a county that decides not to prosecute marijuana crimes, does that mean it's not a crime?
I wouldn't say that. Possession of marijuana is
But my point is that we can't judge by how strenuously something's enforced about whether it fits as a crime or not for purpose of interpreting the statute.
That's fair, and I've been prepared to talk about a few examples that might go to the court's question, which is, if you look at Title 49, 434A, that makes it a misdemeanor to operate a vehicle in Idaho without proper registration or paying operating costs. So if a manager is driving a company-owned vehicle on expired plates, is that sufficiently illegal, even though he treated it as a misdemeanor, to warrant dissolution? Manager could go in and get the plates current and cure the issue. Same goes for a lot of construction, and Idaho requires our contractors to register. It is, in fact, a misdemeanor to perform contracting services without registering. And that's Idaho Code 5254.
My school, Mr. Anderson, is it seems like we're getting back to this is absurd to treat these violations as sufficient to dissolve, and the court has repeatedly said we interpret the law as written. We don't rewrite it to avoid an absurd result. That's what the legislature does. So that's one point. But my other concern is when we talk about was it treated as a civil violation or a criminal violation, the statute doesn't condition dissolution on a criminal conviction. It talks about if the district court entered an order based on illegal conduct or acting in a way that was illegal. And so that language suggests to me a conviction isn't required. So help me understand how I get when there's no mention of they have to be convicted of anything, why we would interpret it as it's only illegal if they're convicted criminally.
Well, I think that's one factor, Your Honor, and that's what I struggle with. We're trying to find authorities to address this act. The best I can do is find authorities in the corporate context because I think the court is called upon to address the question as what is sufficiently illegal to then lead to the dissolution of an LLC. And we provided one of the only authorities we could find, which was a a district court case in the federal district in Maine, the Thompson's Point case. That case had to do with a sprinkler system that was inoperable, which created a building code violation, and then also the corporation hired unlicensed contractors to attempt to evade asbestos. And the district court in that case said, we don't condone, or I don't, speaking for himself, but I don't condone building code violations, and I don't condone hiring unlicensed contractors to cure asbestos. But the court's conclusion was that that's not sufficiently the type of illegality to warrant dissolution.
And that raises a question for me, if you don't mind my interrupting. Regardless of how, well, let me back up here. The court determined that the conduct was illegal in maintaining the cabin in the violation status that it was. Did that mandate the district court to enter an order of dissolution? In other words, I'm saying if there's illegal conduct, was the district court required to dissolve under Section 30-25-701?
That's a great question. I don't believe so. I believe the court had discretion and chose to conclude that it was illegal. But we, at every point we could, ask the district court to define illegal. And the district court rejected that, never engaged in analysis even for this court to review about what is sufficiently illegal.
So does that argument that you're making, the sufficiency of the illegality, go to the trial court's exercise of discretion in deciding to dissolve the corporation?
I think it could. I've always looked at it as the question is before this court being one of law to determine what, defining what the legislature meant when it used illegal.
Well, illegal is illegal, to Justice Zahn's point, perhaps. And so if that's the case, is there room in there for you to make a different kind of argument with respect to the district court's discretion to dissolve?
Well, on that point, and that's something else that's not in the record, because the court didn't do the Lundberg analysis of, you know, exercising its discretion, although I believe it could have. But it simply found the violations to be sufficiently illegal without any analysis of what that meant.
Did the district court believe it was bound to dissolve if there was illegal conduct?
I don't know that it ever came up that way. I interpret from the way that the court treated the post-trial ruling and then the ruling on reconsideration that it was required to dissolve the LLC. Well, talking about reconsideration, the only basis for dissolving the LLC was the existence of the notices of violation being recorded. And those were cured and removed from the record within 30 days of the district court's decision. We presented that to the district court, and the district court found that the managers had acted in a way that was illegal. But my thought there is that I think we first have to define if the zoning and building code violations are the type of illegality that could lead to dissolution, which the U.S. Supreme Court has referred to that result as being corporate debt. So I'm going to reserve what little time I have left to respond to any arguments that come up with Mr. Max today.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel, Courtland Charter Academy. My name is John Magnuson. I represent Respondent Anne-Marie Beardsley today. I appreciate Counsel's argument. There were a lot of issues presented in the briefing. It was a lengthy briefing. I'll probably try to use Counsel's argument as a roadmap to try to respond to those arguments rather than hash things that don't need hashing. With respect to the applicability of the Idaho Limited Liability Company Act and the ability to seek a statutory dissolution of the company under 30-25-704, I think that issue is pretty clear and the preamble to the operating agreement says it will be in accordance with the Act as amended. So I don't think we'd merit much more time, it seems, for focusing on what does the word illegal mean.
One question that I had regarding the waiver issue is, how do you resurrect a waiver?
How do you resurrect a waiver? Well, it said it was waived as it is. The legislature's determined that you can't waive that right. So,
I said resurrect. I mean, how do you, I mean, just suddenly just disregard it? I mean, the parties entered into an agreement understanding that, waiving a particular right, and then we just disregard it.
Well, the legislature determined as a matter of legislation that that was against public policy, apparently, because no operating agreement of any LLC in Idaho anymore, whether it was created before 2015 or after, can waive a member's right, even if they agree to seek a dissolution based on illegal or oppressive conduct. So the resurrection was accomplished through legislative action. Back to the illegality, which we seem to be talking about, it's sort of like the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court trying to define what was obscenity at one time. I know it when I see it. I'd like to use the definition employed by the appellants in their briefing. Justice Ahn noted a dictionary reference would be the New Oxford American Dictionary defines illegal as, quote, contrary to or forbidden by law. Sounds like unlawful, but especially criminal law. And there is repeated reference in the briefing and the argument in characterizing the notices of violation as civil regulatory infractions. Again, in Kootenai County, the ordinances were attached to the briefing as exhibits, but right, wrong, or indifferent, in Kootenai County, to go build a house without a permit is a misdemeanor punishable by a defined jail term and a defined fine. Building the second house on the same legal parcel in the rural zone is defined as a criminal misdemeanor. I didn't write them, I just play the ball where it lies, but that's what the law is. So taking this definition of contrary to or forbidden by law, especially criminal law, they're not civil regulatory infractions, they are criminal law. You asked the question, Justice Meyer, I believe, about whether or not the district court had discretion after making a specific finding that these constituted criminal acts. And Section 30.25.704, I submit, does not give the district court the discretion, having made it the determination that this was illegal conduct, because the statute says the company is dissolved and its activities and affairs must be wound up upon the occurrence of the following. The managers or those acting in control have acted in a manner that's illegal.
Except there's some language in between there. Subsection 4, the entry by the district court of an order dissolving the company on the grounds that. So the code section doesn't read dissolution is mandatory upon the members acting illegally. It's mandatory upon the district court's entry of an order. And not just an order finding that they acted illegally, but an order dissolving the company on the grounds that. So when I read that sure sounds like the district court gets to exercise some discretion. It doesn't say you have to enter an order, district court.
Well, it says, I have two answers. One, it says you can enter an order. The district court can enter an order if it finds illegal conduct. I think you can agree on that. I believe you're trying to suggest. I wouldn't argue with you, but I guess that's what you're doing today. In either instance, the district court exercised its discretion in this case based on these facts, based on this finding. So I think it's a question that doesn't necessarily need an answer, because based upon how the district court determined it and made its findings in this case, it properly acted to find illegal conduct and dissolved in its discretion, if that is in fact an element.
And my concern, Mr. Magnuson, is when I read the district court's decision, I'm concerned the district court thought it was mandatory. I don't know that I see the district court exercising discretion on whether to dissolve. I read it as the district court thought, okay, there's been a finding of illegality and I'm bound to dissolve.
There's certainly no recognition of discretion expressed or any of the analysis that we typically see in the Lauterberg case.
There is a litany of thought, process, findings, and conclusions by the district court. See, sometimes we get lost in this argument that a tree fell in the forest and two notices of violation were recorded in 2012 and nothing ever happened with them. And that we're trying a technicality. But when you look at the complete findings of the district court, you have notices of violation that were issued, that's illegal conduct, but they continued, which was continuing illegal conduct. And then when notified in the case that this was the basis for seeking dissolution, they did absolutely nothing to the chagrin of the district court, who made a point of noting, I'm rather incredulous that the defendants knew of these notices of violation and that you knew that this was a basis for seeking dissolution, and you did nothing. And in fact, his finding or his conclusion was, essentially what the defendants did was to double down and say, I don't care if they are illegal and on the parcel of property that Ann Beardsley owns, I don't care and I'll let them stay there until 2044. And so when you say that there weren't specific findings of an exercise of some degree of thought and comprehension and deliberative action, other than just saying, here's a couple of notices of violation, that's it, it was somewhat more involved in the analysis than that. It was also probative to the district court that, 5-7 days before trial, we're faced with a motion in limine seeking to exclude the testimony of the planning director, seeking to exclude the notices of violation themselves, and the supporting declaration is filed by one of the defendants, Mr. Munt, who says under oath, these were all resolved, which is exactly contrary to the testimony he offered at his deposition, which was not lost on the district court when he found those statements to be false. And it was also confirmed by the testimony of the planning director. So, a long answer to your question about whether there's some deliberative thought as to the context of the illegal conduct arising out of the notices of violation to form a basis for dissolution in this action, I would suggest that there was. And I would suggest that, I would simply suggest that the definition proffered by the appellants of contrary to or forbidden by law, especially criminal law, should suffice. But there was some argument about the motion for reconsideration. These notices of violation, which constitute a new violation every day, again, I didn't write the legislation, and the wisdom of that is something, it's not my bailiwick, but every day is a new criminal misdemeanor. To then go out after trial's over and tear the cabin down and then come back and seek absolution through a motion for reconsideration, that one just seems to be directly contrary to this court's teaching. I think a couple of times, the last time I was before this honorable court was I was bringing a motion for reconsideration in the Midtown Ventures case. And I brought a motion for reconsideration based upon an assignment of a contract that was assigned after it had been argued and before it had been decided. And then it was put in after it had been decided. And well, I took it on the chin that day.
Well, that day you were dealing with perhaps deathbed repentance. Here we have an after-death repentance, which I agree seems to be a different matter. Let me ask you, counsel, on the on this issue, appellant suggests that your client participated in the illegality by helping construct the cabin, albeit that was 25 years ago. But he suggests that she's trying to benefit from illegal conduct that she participated in and holding it against everyone else, but she's not responsible. You want to respond to that argument?
Sure. I appreciate the opportunity to respond to that. I'd say both from a factual and a legal standpoint. From a factual standpoint, sometimes we cherry pick a statement out of the record and give it life that's greater than it is. Sort of like saying Director Callahan said these violations are commonplace. That's not exactly what he said. He said it's commonplace to leave the violations in place because, frankly, they don't have enough manpower in the county, as he testified, to go out and fill it. In this case, where she testified was, and it was actually agreed to by the other family members on the other side, was that she attempted to screw some planks on the deck, and she didn't do a very good job about it.
How old was she at the time she participated in the construction? I mean, no, it's not usually polite to ask how old someone is, but that might make a difference in this case.
Well, I'm going to be older than 21. So, but my second answer to you, that was from a factual, but from a legal standpoint, and this was a finding made by the district court, that the illegal conduct occurred and was occurring, and it continued to occur. So the illegal conduct also included, after you have notice, managers, of the recordation and clouding of the title of the notice of violation, you allow them to remain and take no responsive action to correct the violation, to remove the cloud from the property and remove the damage that is occurring to this member, my client. So this isn't just the notice of violation recorded in 2013. The lawsuit's filed, and it goes on ad nauseum for several years, like lawsuits do now. And in these notices, every day is a new violation. You, the managers, learn about it. You learn again, as I said, that we're seeking dissolution on this basis. And no one does anything. So the district court found that not only was allowing them to be recorded in the first instance, whether she participated in putting on some deck is irrelevant. But when it continues, she doesn't have the power or authority to remove them.
Counsel has suggested that she was aware of the illegality and was aware that the county wasn't happy with things. Do you contest that?
I don't believe that's supported by the record. The record demonstrates that the first time my client became aware of these notices of violation was during the pendency of this action, and that her father told her that they had all been taken care of. And of course, the last family meeting was the infamous meeting of January of 2018, and nothing ever happened after that. That's what the record shows.
So both sides in this dispute acknowledge that Jim Sr. or I assume Jim Sr. said, don't worry about it, it's been taken care of. I mean, so what I understand from the testimony is that Jim Jr. and or Larry had said, the previous managers told us, don't worry about the notices of violation that have been taken care of. And then your client also said that's what Dad said?
The testimony, I don't believe that's accurate, okay. Justice Meyer. The testimony from Larry Mike prior trial was that his father-in-law had gone down and tried to resolve them, but the proposed resolution hadn't been accepted and that the violations remained unresolved. That was Larry's testimony prior to trial, which was, again, he was reminded of a trial. Jim was asked the question and said, I don't know, I refer to Larry.
Okay.
Then on the week before trial, Larry said, also under oath, that these were all fixed, which, of course, they weren't. So
I understand. Thank you.
My client, the record indicates that my client was told by her father at the meeting that these had been handled.
At the January 2018 meeting?
I believe so, but I can't state that with certainty.
So she did know about the violation before filing suit?
She didn't know about the recorded violations. She was told that the issues, whatever they were, had been handled.
she knew that there were issues then?
I would say that's accurate.
Okay.
But she said they had been handled by her boss.
So am I understanding you're saying, yes, she was aware of issues, but she thought they weren't issues anymore?
Correct.
When she filed. And
correct.
So when I look at the record, I see she says, hey, the first time I learned they hadn't been handled was during discovery.
That's true.
And so I understand how that could lead to her not pleading any facts and her complaint about the violations, because she thought they'd been resolved. And so when she learns that they haven't been resolved, why not amend the complaint to include those allegations and specifically state a claim?
The complaint, it stated a specific claim under 3025.704.84c, which included the subordinate elements. And then, of course, this was the argument made by Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson moved for summary judgment 14 months before trial. And as you know, then corroborating what my client said about finding these out through discovery, it's like, well, you better put up or shut up at this point in time. So we brought the notice as a violation. And under the code section, as cited both in the complaint as a cause of action and in a prayer for relief, said, by the way, this is illegal too.
And my struggle, Mr. Magnuson, is there's no facts in the complaint as pled to support dissolution on the basis of illegality. And so where they object, and I understand the district court's ruling, I mean, they didn't consent to trying the issue. There were no facts pled in the complaint. I understand the facts came to light later in discovery, but why not amend the complaint if you're saying, no, we're also moving on these bases too because we've learned these things weren't resolved. Why wasn't the complaint ever amended to include those allegations as a basis for dissolution?
I'd say two answers. One, in light of the rather lengthy summary judgment decision that was authored by Judge Christensen, it was not perceived that was necessary at any point in time because the judge understood that the issue was in front of him and addressed it and resolved it. So that would simply be, I mean, not an unnecessary act, but obviously you believe it might have been necessary, but I don't think in the context of this case that would have been particularly necessary. But then if that thought process is employed, we have the appellant here today arguing that my client waited too long and there's no statute of limitation defense of any kind in the answer. And so, you ask the questions, but I just posed the rhetorical. Well, after that decision, why didn't they amend their complaint to assert a specific claim of statute of limitations, but they let that there for 13 months? They're arguing to the court about timeliness today, but there's no statute of limitations defense. So, I mean, sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander. That's how I'd respond to that.
Counsel, would you like to address the parade of horribles that appellant suggests in interpreting the word illegal broadly as written? He has suggested that if a director fails to register a company car or a company car gets a parking violation while attending a company meeting, that those would all be illegal acts that would allow a member to seek dissolution?
Well, it is an interesting question. It does say illegal. We agree, I think, that criminal conduct constitutes illegal. We may have a philosophical disagreement about whether or not a regulatory infraction should be criminal, but this legislative body has defined it as criminal. So I don't know that you need to get to the parade of horribles to determine whether or not this fits within the statute. I kind of went look at this and say, did the legislature really intend to create a roving judiciary to weigh what every conduct is and to say, do I think this is illegal enough to constitute dissolution or is it not illegal enough? I mean, if the manager hits the member with a 2x4 in the head, is that good enough? Or if the manager takes $100 out of the company till, is that good enough? I don't know that we need to go down that analysis because those facts aren't here today. But what we're here today on is...
I hope you understand the concern, though. Assuming we agree with you, I hate to wake up the morning after the opinion is issued to find out that half the corporations and LLCs in the state are being dissolved because not all of the board of directors are good Boy Scouts.
Well, and I think the answer to that question is if the court is inclined to find that the criminal conduct in this case is sufficient to merit dissolution under the statute, that the decision is predicated to the facts of this particular case as found by the district judge at great length, and as I've tried to expound upon, to say this isn't just two notices of violation recorded in a vacuum. This is two notices of violation that were brought to the manager's attention, and they obdurately and willfully refused to correct and remove them, a point that is even made more glaringly and alarming that after the judge decides you go out and tear down the cabin. Counsel said this may be an issue of first impression. Well, these facts may be a one-off, too.
So your answer, though, suggests the court then, when it analyzes whether something's illegal or unlawful, it can investigate into the specifics and determine whether or not it was committed long ago, determine whether or not it's been ongoing. It sounds like if we're going to allow a court to look into, not treat it as black and white, but look at the shades of gray associated with it, then maybe unlawful doesn't necessarily mean unlawful.
Well, I think unlawful means unlawful. I gave that answer in response to Justice Mueller, your question about, you know, waking up and being afraid that we're going to have an exodus of LLCs because of unintended consequences. And you know, do I think illegal is illegal, or do I think I know what it means? I think I know what it means. I think the district court knew what it meant. But I don't think it's a legitimate concern to, you know, parade the horribles because a decision by this court, you're the architects, a decision by this court could make this case limited to these facts, which I hear what you're saying, but I'm answering your question assuming that there is some discretion, and I'm not necessarily saying there is. I guess I got 7 minutes left. I'm glad the clock's in front of me when we're at the Midtown. And I opened up, and it was a new experience for me because as I get older, my eyes don't work, my clock was far away, and I have 30 minutes, and I had time for the vote. And you guys kept me busy that day, so I used all 30 minutes, and I never had anything in rebuttal. So I'm glad the clock's closed today because I realized I have 6.5 minutes left. The one thing I haven't touched on, and it's been an interesting and collegial discussion today, is the alternative cause. Obviously, I'm here today arguing that the district court's decision should be affirmed on the basis of illegality. But we also raised by the cross appeal, which I raised by cross appeal as of abundance of belts and suspenders, so I wouldn't be here to say right result, wrong reason. I did it that way because you understand. And so, you know, once again, illegal, what's that mean? Well, we bandied about that for almost an hour. What's oppression mean? And oppression, you know, we have all the touchstones, all the kind of general cases that say, you know, not in good faith, not in fair dealing, lacking of probity. I know it when I see it. Well, ultimately, I want to make clear that when we raised this cross appeal and we briefed it, we're not challenging the district court's findings of fact. The findings of fact in a decision whether or not there was sufficient oppression to merit dissolution of the company is a fact issue. Whether those facts as found constitute oppression, this amorphous term that we attempt to give life to, is a question of law, which this court may revisit anew. And I would suggest, and of course, once again, not unlike the last one, we don't have a lot of Idaho cases on the word oppression in the Limited Liability Company Act. So, we look at other places, they come up with those definitions. We have, when you talk about oppression here, we finally get away from the notices of violation. We have a company agreement in 2006 that's supposed to resolve all the issues of this company. And then that, as appears much in the record, apparently changed his mind, apparently got irritated, apparently did what Dad was going to do, and appears in the record that everybody listened to Dad because they were kind of afraid of Dad. So Dad changes the agreement unilaterally, but it doesn't include any signature of my client who was a signatory to the agreement. The point of that is that when you look at the context of oppression, what Mr. Munt did was he had the agreement, he had the ability to seek grants to do work on the company property and to make all money he could from the grants, but he had to pay the expenses. And then it's like, ollie ollie oxen free, dad told me I don't have to pay attention to that anymore. 3 weeks before trial, a capital account sheet is prepared, signed by the managers, acknowledged to be an effort to bind the company to pay these obligations. The managers signed a capital account intending to bind the company to pay them $200,000 in expenses that Mr. Munt agreed to assume in contract. They signed a capital account 3 weeks before trial that would reimburse Jim for $43,000 he claimed to have incurred before we even had a company, before he was even a member. It included $97,000 for the cost of the Munt cabin, with 43.01% being attributed to my client. I wouldn't be surprised if we leave here today and you know, whatever happens, we're going to get 43.01% of the cost of removing the thing, too. Falsifying the meeting minutes in January 2018. What Jim did was to tell the court through discovery responses sworn that my client said to her parents in January of 2018, I will sell this house out from under you. He said that under oath. When confronted with the actual meeting minutes, he acknowledged that was untrue because she made no such statement. When she asked after invasive surgery that you please don't run your cattle within 5 feet of my house and here's the alternative route, she gets a draft complaint to disassociate her if she doesn't pipe down. There has been no distribution of taxes to her as the largest equity owner, despite the fact that the logging operation in 2017 through 2019 that generated the funding was done based upon the specific representation, quote, the logging is going to pay the bills so you don't have to come up with money for taxes, quote. What I could go on. I think you get the drift. These were all outlined in great detail. What my suggestion or request is that if the court is inclined to not find that illegality is a sufficient basis, I certainly think that the evidence unquestionably demonstrates in this instance that there was oppressive conduct. I mean, I said we leave the notices of violation behind. Judge Christensen found it incredibly probative that when asked on the witness stand, Jim, manager, are you intending to get rid of these notices of violation? No, I don't care. I'm happy to leave them there until the rest of the company term is done. And then you take, you know, it was characterized, I don't know that the judge really thought of it as oppression, but I certainly argued it as oppression, that when you are the manager of the company and you're defending a lawsuit against the largest equity holder, I think general principles of probity and fair dealing would countenance that you don't file an affidavit a week before a trial with an objectively false statement in order to preclude admissibility of the notices of violation. I think that in the grand constellation of this sordid affair constitutes oppressive conduct.
If we do closely consider that, counsel, and I'm sure we will, I mean, how do we distinguish what you're describing between either A, ordinary family drama, telling one of your children to pipe down because you don't like it when they complain, and B, discovery misconduct, which now we're trying to characterize as oppressive conduct for the purposes of managing the LLC?
Well, I think in the context of the affidavit to preclude admissibility, the notice is a violation. You're taking action on behalf of the company and defend it through the managers, which she is not. And you're taking action to ask the court to not consider the notices of violation so that she cannot pursue redress as she's lawfully able to pursue as a member, the largest member. But you're making a knowingly false statement in your corporate status for purposes of keeping down the largest bank. And I think that is oppressive.
If I may, yes. I'm just trying to distinguish between a litigation tactic in the midst of a lawsuit and oppressive conduct in the management of a business. I understand they're closely related. I'll grant you that. But it just seems like to use conduct during the course of litigation as a basis for justifying bringing the litigation strikes me as like a little weak.
Well, I would, and I have, with no disrespect, I don't think a litigation tactic properly countenances filing a false affidavit.
Fair enough.
I mean, that one may be a little bit above and beyond simply vigorously arguing for one's rights. One's rights should not be predicated upon an objectively false affidavit.
I certainly didn't say it was a good litigation tactic. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
3 minutes, Your Honor.
Sir?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just nature of kind of bouncing around here, I apologize. The question came up about whether Ms. Beardsley knew going back to 2013 about the violations, and I can point the court to pages 663 and 664 of the transcript where she acknowledged she had a conversation with her parents in 2013. Another point that was made about the capital accounts, Judge Christensen in his decision following trial on the record on page 1127 stated the capital accounts, the issue there by itself was not considered to be impressive. One thing I'd like to point out is I heard the respondents counselor Crossfield say that they're not here to challenge findings of fact. The legal framework for oppression that the district court applied was the exact legal framework that Ms. Beardsley advanced to the district court, all the way down to citing to the official comments and to the authorities that Ms. Beardsley advanced, the Davis versus Sheeran, Texas case, and Baker versus Commercial Bodybuilders. So Ms. Beardsley set out what she considered to be oppression and now is wanting to argue whether those facts sufficiently rise to the level of oppression. I think that one of the things that I overlooked, and Justice Mulder, you asked a question about, do the specifics matter? And is there a gray area when you're looking at the question of illegality? I don't know that a bright line rule that it has to absolutely be criminal, to your point about health and safety violations or other things that could put the public at risk. But what I do believe in trying to offer my best help to the court in fashioning a test for what constitutes illegality is the fact should matter. The shades of gray should matter. And going back to my example of not registering your plates, and let's say you got a flower shop and the manager's racing to the store to get to, buy some snacks for the staff, and the plates are expired. So is that going to automatically lead to dissolution? Well, let's just change that hypothetical a little bit. What if the company-owned vehicle, the purpose of the business is a rideshare, and now you have manager operating a company-owned vehicle where the actual part of the business is a rideshare operating cars. And I think you could take the same example as it relates to reckless driving. It's a misdemeanor in Idaho. And so maybe that same manager at the flower shop hastening to get snacks for the staff is engaged in reckless driving as a misdemeanor. But what if they're on the clock operating a vehicle as a rideshare? So I do think that you can have different facts that do actually inform the shades of gray, to use your frame. I'm out of time. I appreciate the court's opportunity to present.
Thank you very much, sir. With that, counsel, this matter is under advisement. We'll render a decision accordingly. For the students present, we're going to take just a moment, as we do in every case, and shake the hands of the lawyers, and we'll come back up here and then take any questions you might have for a few minutes. Thank you.
All rise, please.